In these evening talks, we'll be exploring these different paramis, these beautiful qualities of the heart. And today the particular focus is on truthfulness. So we'll be exploring the parami of truthfulness, this dedication to truth. And the Buddha said, a wise person, upon acknowledging the truth, becomes like a lake, clear and deep and still. Find friends who love the truth. So I'm reflecting on that. It's clear that the kind of truth that we're talking about is a truth that transforms. Yeah? So upon acknowledging the truth, the person doesn't simply find a new piece of information, or have a new fact to store away, or have a new book to put on the shelf. But it's a transformative discovery. It's a liberating discovery. The person becomes like a lake, clear and deep and still. So this dedication to truth is dedication to a truth that's really revolutionary in our lives, profoundly transformative in our lives. Another thing I like about this quotation is when it says, find friends who love the truth. Yeah? So hopefully that's what we've done this week, yeah? In coming together, a sense of how much we support each other in our dedication to practice and dedication to freedom and peace. So commitment to honesty allows us to discover what is true and to live in that truth. So the truth that really permeates our lives and is then of course expressed in the way that we speak. So this is clearly linked with wise speech. Sometimes in understanding a quality, it's interesting to look at its opposite. So in thinking about truthfulness, I'm going to begin really by just exploring its opposite and thinking what it's like when we're dishonest or when there's dishonesty around. And begin with a personal story. So when I was a teenager, I lived with my dad and my stepmom in London. And it was a happy time. I mean, stepmoms get a bad press sometimes, don't they? But I'm lucky enough to have had a very loving stepmom, so it was a very nice situation. But for various reasons, and to be honest with you, now looking back, very, very understandable reasons. I'm certainly not judging my earlier self, and really understandable reasons. I didn't want the people around me to know that she was my stepmom. I wanted them to think that she was my biological mum, you know, because it felt private, perhaps. It felt something to be defended. And this went on over the years, and I developed some very close friendships. And over time, this kind of dishonesty became increasingly difficult to maintain, and the kind of effort to keep it going became quite strong. And my dad and his new wife, my stepmom, got married, I think, when I must have been about 14 or something like that. And there was a picture of them, their wedding photograph, in the front room. And then I had this thing, this friend can't come in the front room because he's going to see this photo of my dad and his wife clearly getting married about 2 years ago. And, you know, how's that going to work? And how am I going to kind of maintain this? And, I also hadn't checked the story with my older brother, so he told different things to different people. So anyway, over time it became increasingly difficult to kind of maintain this pretense. But what I remember was the day, a really close friend of mine at the time, when the truth sort of came out really. He said to me, look, you know, I've been speaking to your brother and, you know, I think I know what's happening. But I just remember this enormous relief. I mean, just really delightful sense of being able to put that down, to being able to put down the pretense or the complexity or the strategies for maintaining this thing that wasn't true. And like I say, I mean, I really don't, it's not a sense of saying it's, you know, it's bad to be dishonest or, and, you know, that maybe at some stages in our life things do feel very fragile and very delicate. And it's understandable that these kind of barriers might be there. But as they release, just that liberation really in coming back into the truth and what that did to that friendship. Because truth opens up the opportunity for connection. And dishonesty so often can separate us and make us feel isolated. Sharon Salzberg also tells a story about how dishonesty can reveal the value of truthfulness. I shall share some of this with you. She describes how she was living in a house with some friends, and another friend of ours who lived nearby decided to go to India to practice meditation. Because she knew that her mother would worry, she did not want her to know that she was going alone. So she lied by telling her mother that her husband was going to India too, when in fact he was not. She also gave her mother the number at her house to call if any emergency should come up. About 24 hours before my friend was due home from India, her mother called us to ask, "Have you heard from my daughter or her husband?" The person who answered the phone did not remember the lie in that moment, so he blurted out, "Oh yes, her husband was just here for dinner." When he realized what he'd done, he tried to set things right by telling another lie. He said, you know, he went with her to India, but he had a business meeting and came back early for it. Right away, our friend's mother knew that something was wrong, that she was not being told the truth. She panicked. "What aren't you telling me? She's sick. She's very sick. She's beyond sick. What's going on?" My housemate said, no, she's fine. She'll be home in another day. A few minutes after that phone call, another friend called and said, "Do you know who just called me? Our friend's mother." This woman was so ill at ease about what she had been told that she'd started calling around the community to see if someone would tell her the truth about her daughter. Now we thought that we'd better call everybody before she did so that we could instruct them as to what lie to tell. At one point, someone none of us knew called. It turned out that the mother had enlisted a neighbour, thinking that if we would not tell her the truth, we might tell someone else the truth. Then we had to call everybody again to alert them about another person who might call and which lies to tell. Right in the middle of this whole episode, we began receiving anonymous, obscene phone calls. Normally with such calls, we would have just stopped answering the phone, but we had to answer because someone might call about the situation with our friend's mother, and we had to be ready to tell them the right lie. Finally, one of our friends just gave up. She could not bear it anymore. The next time she talked to our friend's mother, she said, "You're right. We haven't been telling you the truth. This is the truth. The husband never went to India. Your daughter went alone. She's fine. She'll be home in a day." Two interesting things happened at that point. First, the mother had been lied to so much that she did not believe the truth when she heard it. The other thing was that I saw in my own mind that I'd told so many lies by then that I did not know what was true anymore. Confusion reigned. Did he go to India? What's going on? I began to see once again the power of truth and what it means for another and for oneself to deny that power. In the light of seeing the effects of untruthfulness, we can make a commitment to truthfulness. So So again, there's that sense of the complexity, the difficulties we can get into through dishonesty, even dishonesty rooted in some kind of, you know, seemingly good intention can create so much complexity. What a tangled web we weave when we conspire to deceive. So if dishonesty can create that separation, honesty, truthfulness creates intimacy. Creates intimacy with others, intimacy with ourselves, and intimacy with life. Again, another time from my teenage years that I remember very distinctly, really. There's just a couple of friends and me, just at somebody's house, and I think he had some incense, and he played some quite nice, gentle music. And I couldn't quite tell you why, what happened, but we just, for that time, really opened up to each other in a way that we hadn't done before. And I think for me it was an experience of a deeper kind of friendship that at that time anyway was relatively rare. You know, I don't know what your school days were like, but I mean, you know, sometimes in a London school where I was growing up, I mean, it wasn't necessarily a lot of intimacy. It wasn't a lot of being able to show your vulnerabilities or, you know, really explore how you're feeling. It was more, you know, being tough and streetwise and everything's all right and on top of things. And so just when that opportunity for the more intimate communication opened up, it was beautiful, really lovely. And I always remember that evening. And I don't know whether we can think of our own examples where we've had conversations that are at a certain level, and then for whatever reason it drops, it deepens. And I think this happens when that whole project of creating and defending a self-view begins to disappear. You know, those conversations where, you know, we're so sure we're right and we're so sure the other person's wrong, and it's the kind of battle or conversation where we think, I've got to appear this and I've got to appear that. And then conversations where we just can be, well, you know, say psychologically bare, really, psychologically naked even. You know, just open. And that intimacy is a wonderful thing. In opening ourselves to truthfulness, we also begin to let go of shame. I don't know if you've noticed it over these couple of days, but all kinds of things arise during meditation. Wonderful, noble thoughts, thoughts that aren't so noble, thoughts that we'd love to share with others, thoughts that we might feel, this is the real me. You know, this wonderful, noble intention. And then other thoughts that definitely not me. They're nothing to do with me. That must be someone else's thought popping up in my head, you know. Whether they're sort of, yeah, I don't know, judgmental thoughts or inappropriate thoughts of one kind or another. But the truthfulness in meditation is, as we've been saying, making space for all of that. And from the meditative perspective, there's nothing that doesn't belong. Nothing that doesn't belong. Yeah, there's that discernment that knows what's wholesome, knows what's unwholesome, and that's there too. But that's different from a judgment. It's different from a, this shouldn't be happening. And it's just coming to my mind again, actually, something that, slightly paraphrase, I can't remember exactly what he says, but when Jung talks about, you know, looking at the shadow or bringing light to the shadow, that's the really liberating thing, not constructing some image of being a good person or an image of a person who never has, you know, I don't know, angry thoughts or hateful thoughts or difficult thoughts, but constructing that image and holding on to it, kind of keeps us stuck, really. But the transformative practice is to really see it all. Really see it all. I was talking to Caroline about it earlier this week, really, but, you know, I'm relatively new to this meditation teaching. I've been doing about 3 years now. And but I was just saying to her, again, how really not wanting to pick up another self-image, you know, an image of being a meditation teacher. And when you pick up any self-image, it's really heavy, really heavy. You know, some idea that because I, you know, I'm teaching this, I never have a bad mood, or, you know, I don't know, some kind of idealized image. And whenever I sort of feel myself getting into that, it's really, like I said, it's like a weight on the shoulders. So the truth that just can allow all the parts of ourselves, you know, the bits that we're proud of, the bits we're not proud of, yeah, it's all welcome. So the truthfulness that's a parami is an ennobling truth. I'm sure you're familiar with the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And many teachers prefer to translate that as the Four Ennobling Truths. They're the truths that make us noble. Looking into these aspects of life, the struggle, the origin of the struggle, the end of the struggle, and the path, is a freeing thing, an ennobling thing, a transformative truth. When we're thinking about truth as expressed through speech, of course it's also important to combine that with a sense of kindness and a sense of gentleness and what's meaningful. So a dedication to truth doesn't mean that we have to kind of blurt out all kinds of hurtful truths to people at kind of inappropriate times, but there's a wisdom there, you know, to find the right time, the right place, the right moment to share truth. Yeah. Similarly, I don't think it means kind of stopping every other person on the street and saying, "Have you heard about the Four Noble Truths? This is really, really wonderful, and you must hear this," and that kind of thing. You know, so the way that we live our truth and the way we express our truth needs to be appropriate to the situation. And the truth that we're exploring can include the depth of spiritual insights to dependent origination, emptiness, the Four Noble Truths. And also includes, as part of all of that, our very human frailties, if you like, our very human life. Martin Batchelor describes how at a funeral, there was a Zen teacher conducting a funeral, and it was a funeral for a friend of his. And for part of the funeral, I think he will have been, you know, reciting some verses about, you know, form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, all that arises ceases, that kind of thing. And then he sort of stopped doing that, and you know, then he'd start crying because he missed his friend. You know, he's sort of really in touch with that part of it again. So, you know, cry for his mourning his friend, and then, okay, form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, back to that. And to me, this really says a lot, you know, that those spiritual insights don't deny our humanity. They're part of our humanity, express our humanity. And, you know, these teachings taught a lot about non-attachment and about equanimity, but that's really not anything that denies those human feelings, the fact that we're sensitive beings. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't want to turn into a piece of wood. Yeah, it doesn't feel anything. And, you know, things come and go, and it's just kind of there, blank and unaffected. You know, The liberation that we're exploring and the truth that we're exploring, yes, it's about a stillness with all that change, but it's also about an intimacy. Yes, it's about letting go of attachment, but it's also about being touched. That's some of the kind of paradoxes of spiritual practice. And truth too can include that which we don't know. I don't know if you're familiar with the Archbishop of Canterbury, but he's somebody I respect very much actually. But one of the things phrases he uses sometimes is, it's not the kind of truth that can be written on the back of a postcard, you know. So these kind of spiritual truths or ennobling, liberating truths we're exploring, okay, sometimes they're summed up in formulas, but they really aren't something that you can think, great, I've got it. I know that piece of information, I've written it down, you know, on the back of a postcard, I can take it home. That they're somewhat ungraspable. You know, you might think you've got it. Seems to have slipped. But these deepest questions, you know, who are we? I ordered a talk once called What Is It That's Awake and Aware? I thought, great, I'm going to find out. And I put this talk on and listened to it, and I couldn't give you a one-word answer. You know, the talk didn't have that. What is our true identity? These kind of questions really aren't questions with some kind of straightforward, I'll write it down answer, but it's really about opening to these questions, opening to what we don't know, being receptive to that which is mysterious, profoundly mysterious. These kind of questions, why is there a universe at all? It's just a profoundly mysterious question. Who are we? What happens after death? So this dedication to truthfulness isn't about being a know-all. It's about acknowledging that which is profoundly unknowable. So our dedication to truth can also include our own personal story, our own sense of our own history. I don't know how much we have our own stories or our own narratives about our childhood or about events that have happened to us in life, or our stories about the kind of person that we are. And a dedication to truth means really looking into those kind of stories. How true are those things? I'm the kind of person that, I'm like this because. And really putting those kind of stories in question. And Sylvia Borstein gives a story about this. She tells a story of a woman who didn't eat vegetables. She didn't like vegetables, she said. And when asked, well, you know, why don't you like vegetables? She said, well, it's because my mother forced me to eat them when I was young. And then perhaps at some stage, she had this kind of realization that maybe her dislike of vegetables had come before her mother trying to get her to eat them. And that perhaps why the mother tried to get her to eat them was, you know, because she disliked them. So she realized that this story, which kind of set up her mum as the bad person in this, you know, I don't eat vegetables because my mother was so authoritarian, you know. She thought, well, this is a story, really. And actually, maybe I just didn't like vegetables. And again, you know, it's different for each of us, but we can hold these stories about our past or about what's happened or the kind of person we are or our histories that can keep us somewhat stuck. So dedication to truth is about letting go of stories as ourselves as always being right, which might be a pattern some of us get into, but equally, the stories that we're always wrong, we're never quite good enough, or, you know, it's always my fault. So again, different people have different stories that are more or less loud in their lives. But, you know, seeing the constructed nature of those narratives. You're not building an identity around memory and story. You know, these things really are not the truth of who we are. So there are also particular thought patterns that particularly keep us spinning in struggle, spinning in dis-ease and suffering. And I don't know if you're familiar with cognitive psychology and cognitive behavioral ideas, but I'm borrowing some of their ideas, which seem to me to really fit very neatly with a Dharma understanding about the kind of untruths, really, that can keep us quite stuck. So one is called catastrophizing. Yeah? So seeing things as a catastrophe that aren't really a catastrophe at all. I had a moment today actually when I just picked up my soup at tea, and I think it was, for some reason it was quite hot and the bread was quite hot, and I was just sort of holding it, and then I thought, oh dear, I'm going to drop it in front of everybody, you know. Which obviously, you know, I'd prefer not to do, and it probably would be a little bit embarrassing. But, you know, I think I'd survive, and hopefully he wouldn't all leave, you know. Oh, this is terrible, this guy's teaching us about mindfulness, and look, he's dropped his plate all over the floor, you know. I want my money back, you know, this is a fake, you know. But, you know, these things happen, you know. But how easily we can do that, you know, turn trifling things into, it's awful, it's dreadful. I had an experience in my work at a college. I don't know if you know, but I also work in a college of 16 to 19 year olds. And we use a lot of IT equipment there. And I was trying to show them a video of some kind. And it wouldn't work, as sometimes happens. And I remember the thought pattern started to get going. Oh, you know, nothing ever works in this place. I can't rely on anybody. And it's too, you know, too much to do with IT and new technology anyway. Why don't they bring some proper wisdom into the education system? And, you know, this is not the right place for me. I'm not at home here. And so I've got to get out of this. I need a new job, you know. So there's something's kind of going on. And then I just sort of, I think I did finally get to the stage where I could kind of call one of the technicians who came down and said, oh, you know, the wire's a little bit loose, you know. So what the actual problem was the wire a little bit being loose. But, you know, once when this catastrophizing mind gets going, the problem is the whole institution and, you know, my whole career choice. And the only solution is a new job. Whereas the real solution was, you know, tighten the wire a bit. And I'm sure we all have our own examples. Another kind of thinking that can obscure the truth is what is called, you know, black and white thinking. It's all wonderful. It's all marvelous. It's all absolutely incredible. Or it's all terrible. It's all awful. It's, you know, unbearable. And how we can kind of, you know, move between those extremes. And really healthy to be able to see really, all situations in life bring pleasure, all situations in life bring pain. You know, pleasure, pain, loss, gain, praise and blame. These are around. Yeah. Also when the black and white thinking comes in, as perhaps it did in that example too, you know, it's like this job is just awful. So all the good parts of it are just kind of forgotten. And then if you're not careful, it projects into something else, which is wonderful. And we can see how this links with that craving, that unquenchable thirst that the Buddha identifies as a source of suffering. Yeah. Because if something somewhere else is perfect, where is it? I've got to find it. I've got to get it. And then we're on a task and we think we've got it. Ah, great. Found the perfect job or the perfect relationship or the perfect car or whatever it is. And it's perfect for a bit. And then the image of perfection starts to fade. But if we continue the mythology that the perfect thing exists somewhere, then we're just off again and we're on the round. We're on the round. So just letting go of that black and white thinking, okay, I'm in this situation and it's got pleasure, pain, praise, blame, and it's workable. We can also at times fall into the pattern of personalizing things. Personalizing means it's all to do with me. So Caroline touched on this issue of eye contact on a retreat. A really interesting area to look at. So, you know, and as she was saying, it's lovely at times to connect with people in the silence and have that sense of community. And at other times it's nice to be more inward. The classic example of this kind of personalizing thing is if, you know, somebody doesn't acknowledge us or seems to look in a strange way or, you know, kind of moves past us, that we think it's to do with us, you know, something I've done. He doesn't like me, she doesn't like me. You know, there's something wrong with how I'm behaving that's caused that. But of course, you know, it's, you know, 99 times out of 100, it's nothing to do with us. It's whatever else is happening for that person. And something I think is a particularly dangerous and unwholesome, really, form of falsehood is this them and us thinking. Yeah? Them and us thinking. The world is divided into my lot and the other lot. And you know how often we can do that, whether it's through national identities or religious identities, through, you know, subcultures, small groups, whatever. But there's that lovely sense of belonging that we can feel. But when it's defined as an other being somehow different in some fundamental way. You know, obviously we're all different and there's a very rich diversity in the world, but there's a difference that's, yeah, somehow goes to the core. They're not like us. Yeah. It can be a very, I think a very tricky state of mind, and a state of mind that leads to all kinds of difficulties, you know, when that's too strong, that sense of them and us. So dedication to truth is about feeling that commonality, as we've been talking about. We all suffer, we all want to be happy, we're all born and we're all going to die. And at that level, kind of human level and, you know, beyond the human, really feeling that commonality so we don't get so caught in that them and us. There's a wonderful teacher, I think he's based in Japan, called David Loy. I don't know if you come across him, but I was lucky enough to hear him talk in Devon, and he gave a wonderful talk about this them and us thinking. And, you know, we were all in the room, everybody was really kind of, you know, getting into it, thought, great, this guy's really onto something. And then I think we began to, just very slowly, we began to become conscious of the fact that we'd created a them and us between those of us who are beyond them and us and everybody else who thinks in terms of them and us. Does that make sense? So there became a new us, the people who were beyond them and us, which I thought was quite amusing, really, because it's very pernicious in human life, you know, to feel that, you know. You know, it's like we've got the non-dual people and then the dual people, you know. We're somehow beyond division, becomes another division. He gave a wonderful quotation about that actually. It says, if it were only so simple that the world were divided into good people and evil people, and the evil people could be all put over there and, you know, got rid of or something. If that were how simple the world is. But the reality is that the line between good and evil runs through each of us. So as we dismiss and condemn and judge and shut out others, it's really also part of ourselves is lost in that. So, our dedication to truthfulness also includes our dedication to discovering and exploring and realizing, you know, some of the profound truths of spiritual practice. Understanding the truth of impermanence, of change, of flow. And again, we can see, as I began by saying, that this is a liberating, transformative truth. Yeah. Truth about impermanence is not a fact to know, it's not a piece of information. It's something that radically shapes our whole being. And even though I often teach on impermanence and change, you know, how deep does it really go? I mean, I remember just a few weeks ago, I was getting on a bus in Nottingham, where I live, and I have a little bus pass that lasts for a year. And I like it a lot, actually. Probably quite attached to it. It gets me around all the place. And, I got on the bus and presented this bus pass. And the guy said, "Doesn't work." And I looked at him and said, "What do you mean it doesn't work? It was working this morning." You know, so even though I teach about this impermanence and teach about this change, this idea that things are reliable, you know, this bus pass is somehow some kind of permanent thing that's going to always work, you know. You can run up against these kind of things. How deep that the kind of assumption of reliability and permanence can go. And of course it's that thinking that there's permanence that leads us to cling and grasp. And we're looking for the reliable in the wrong place. We can dedicate ourselves to understanding the truth of suffering and unreliability. So when we turn towards that which is unreliable, turn towards the dissonance, the struggle, the difficulties and suffering in our lives, we really begin to understand, yeah, to understand that suffering. And that's the important thing. It's not that we look at suffering in order to annihilate it or get rid of it or push it away, but we come to understand by turning towards. And we understand that the real struggle in life doesn't lie in external things. That this isn't in place or that isn't in place, or I need more of this or less of that, or something just around the corner. But the real struggle is in that relation to the way things are. Unquenchable thirst for things to be different. So as we come into connection, come into really feeling life as it's flowing through now, and can begin to realize that the liberation from letting go of that unquenchable thirst. And so too we can understand the truth that these patterns, thoughts, feelings, memories, emotions, mental states, all these things that are passing through our experience are not who we really are, not some kind of fundamental identity, nothing to build a self around. And that's a really wonderful lesson of these retreats. In these 2 days, what have you noticed? I mean, how many different mind states have there been? You know, there have been times of, this is lovely, I'm very happy to be here. Times when, oh, this is hard. And times when the mind is full of anger or fear or grief. And other times where there might be a sense of uplift. So really seeing the truth that the changing nature of all those things really indicates that they're not some kind of essence of you. Yeah? Patterns. Arising, passing, coming, going. And they can all be known. Can all be known. So we begin to see the truth that liberates us from that kind of self-definition. And so our commitment to truth is very, very much part of our commitment to freedom, to cultivating this path, and practice for our own benefit and the benefit of others. And this parami of truth is really fundamental, a really integral part of this path of wisdom and compassion and that we're practicing together. So let's just sit quietly together for a couple of minutes. May all beings be free from fear and danger. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings live in truth. May all beings live with ease.